You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
David Goss is in my house. I will not let him sit on the furniture.
No.
He's sitting on the floor right now. Yeah. He doesn't get to have a chair anymore.
That's what I'm willing to do.
Hat trick for Deuce. Two hat tricks in four games.
Are you watching the games? Are you just looking at the stats? Modgepodge.
Hodgepodge?
Hodgepodge.
Modgepodge.
Yeah, there's a modgepodge. Whole modgepodge of rumors.
This is a transfer modgepodge.
It is an ungodly mess.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think about what I want to say.
That's why he's here!
Welcome to Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental on MLSsoccer.com and SiriusXM FC Channel 85. I am David Goss, joined thankfully today by Ben Baer, and out in the octagon is Matt Doyle. No, there's no Andrew Wiebe here for this one. That is because Cameron Russell Wiebe was born on November 11th, 5 pounds, 13 ounces. He is doing fantastic. The mother is doing fantastic. Unsure still of the mental stability of Andrew Wiebe.
We have no idea.
Not related to the child, though. That's just always where it stands. Uh-huh. And happiness in the Extra Time Radio family.
It was such a happy day when we got the text on Friday night.
Technically Saturday morning.
That Cam/Reef was welcomed into this world. And it was a beautiful weekend. Beautiful day.
Wait, Cam/what?
Reef. His nickname is also Reef.
Just like Sharif Abdur-Rahim.
So yeah, that's what it's after. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
A two-day-old baby already has a nickname.
That's how it works.
Among
the ETR crew, that's how it works. I mean, you only need about 5 minutes to get a nickname. So
like Research Bear, Reef.
Yeah,
they're
similar.
Would you train him in your research ways?
Yeah, Wiebe would let me do that. I don't know if he's gonna like let me be around the baby at all. But bears and babies don't really mix that much.
Let me ask you this. Now, there's a difference between a nickname and a brand. Like mm-hmm. Your nickname is Oso, but Armchair Analyst is my brand, right?
Oh my god.
And one of those is a little more important than the other. So is Reef just a nickname or is this his brand?
I think it's just a nickname.
Okay.
Now.
All right. Well, you should work with him.
20 years from now, it could be his brand. We don't know.
I think, yeah, Doyle, I think brands are more self-determined, while nicknames mm-hmm. are given by the ones around
them. No, brands are market-determined, my friend.
One day the market turned to Matt Doyle and said, "You are the armchair
analyst." You are them, yeah.
And that's
how it happened.
And that was how he was created. Well, we've got a lot to talk about on this show. Congratulations, of course, to Andrew. You can send all of those messages to @Folg, F-O-L-G, all the congratulations
also,
messages.
Also, I found it pretty class that in his Twitter announcement, he just tags Landon Donovan in it. So then when anybody replied to it, they're also replying to Landon Donovan. So he's like ensuring that Landon Donovan saw
that
he
did
had a kid.
Him.
And then eventually Landon congratulated him. But who would have known if he never would have tagged Landon?
Ben, that's how you build a brand.
Yeah. Yeah,
and many things were born on this day. Well, we are going to talk about the rebirth of the U.S. national team in the second segment. They are playing Portugal 3:45 p.m. Eastern time on November 14th, Tuesday, in Portugal for the U.S. national to try and turn the page. We'll do all that in the second segment. And here in the first segment, we are going to talk to Brad Friedel, the new head coach of the New England Revolution, announced last week. He gave his first press conference today and then immediately went into the next room, jumped on the phone with us, and really broke it down for all of us. Let's go to that right now. Brad, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. How are you guys doing?
We are doing fantastic. A nice mm-hmm. little lull with international break, but of course, in MLS, the news never stops for you. I don't know that people really expected this coming out right now about you. And when people talk about Brad Friedel, they talk about the great goalkeeper. They talk about your history as a player. When did you realize that coaching was something you wanted to do? Was it always your idea that after playing you were going to go into coaching?
No, not at all. When I was 40, I was at Aston Villa, and I'd got three contract offers, one from Liverpool, one from West Brom, well, four, one at Villa and one at Tottenham. And I wasn't sure I even wanted to play on. But what I did do is spoke to John McDermott, who was at Tottenham's academy. And I decided to go there because he was willing to start me on my coaching journey, so to speak, to see if that was something that I would be interested in. So I started on my UEFA B while I was still playing at Tottenham as a player, and I fell in love with the coaching role. So at that time, I started to do a lot of homework on what coaching actually entailed, And you quickly find out that it's not all about the X's and O's. And I really grew a good mentorship partnership, if you like, with John at Tottenham. And I completed my UEFA A and UEFA Pro license while there. In the meantime, I had also started doing some coaching with Todd Ramos with the under-20 national team. So that was not just this current last cycle, but the cycle before that. And as I grew in the coaching role, then I would coach older players at Tottenham as the years ticked by. And we just developed a fondness for the coaching, and I started reaching out to a lot of my contacts throughout the years that were coaches and retired players that have gone into coaching, and some of them that have gone in on a boardroom level. And I started to do a lot of homework on exactly what it was to manage above you, sideways, and below you at different clubs. I also, when I was fortunate enough to get the head coaching job with U.S. soccer with the 19s, it allowed me to really dive into the world of U.S. soccer and MLS, because I'd been gone for so many years. And the landscape was completely different from the time that I was at Columbus Crew until, fast forward to 2015. So that was imperative. And my work with Fox helped me along the lines with MLS also, going around and doing games and talking to a lot of the owners, a lot of the coaches, a lot of the players, ex-players, and seeing how completely different the landscape was. And it was just all-encompassing. And I have soccer in my blood. I always have. And it's something I can't really see myself doing something outside of soccer. And the coaching, the pressure, the day-to-day, the leadership, that's something that I love doing. So when I was given the opportunity to come in and interview with Robert and Jonathan Kraft and Brian Bolello and Mike Burns and saw what was on offer and saw the squad and saw where they want to take the club and the growth of MLS soccer, it seemed to be a very good partnership.
With your contacts in England, with your background around the world, you've played in CONCACAF. Why here? Why this job and why now?
Well, why now is because my staff and I are ready for it. So that's a why now. The why here, and it didn't matter at the time if the opportunity was here or in Europe or whatever. I wanted to make sure that where I was going into had ambition. I wanted to make sure that the people wanted to win. I wanted to make sure it was a club that was not in disarray, which this most certainly is not when you really dive into the squad. There are tweaks, of course, that need to be made. However, there's not a club in turmoil here, so I think there's a good basis to build on. Contrary to what people want to think or want to say about what the Crafts have done or may not want to do, they are ambitious, and there's a trust and an honesty factor, an integrity factor with Mike Burns. I know him very well. He knows me very well. I was not. Most definitely not hired as his friend, and I know that if I don't do the job, I know exactly what will happen to me. So there, with all those scenarios, I feel that this is a very, very good opportunity for my staff and I to make New England Revolution very successful.
So you just talked about why this job attracted you. Was this actually the first job for a head coach for a club team that you got?
This is definitely not the first time that I have spoken about the possibility of being a head coach. This is the first time that I really explored and dove into taking the job seriously. As you can imagine, around the world, I've spoken to a lot of people, and some of the jobs just didn't fit in with where my ambitions were or where I felt the club's ambitions were. And this was one after I had the second interview. It was one that I really wanted to dive into further. And I liked what I saw. And when I spoke to my staff liked what they saw. And I think it's an important point. From day one of this process, I had my staff with me the whole time. So it was a scenario where if you got me, you got my whole staff. And the staff that is assembled here is a very, very good working staff. We know all areas of the entire world very well within our group, and I've worked with many of these people in different capacities for the last few years. So it's we're very, very excited to get started.
From your side, what was the focus for Mike Burns, for Brian Bolello, for the Crafts, in terms of what they were looking for and what they wanted their next coach to do for this club?
Well, I think they like the fact that I have a lot of contacts globally. I think they like the fact that I knew basically all ages, from the best U17 players in the world all the way up to the senior players. I think they like the fact that I knew who all the agents were globally. I think they like the fact that I'm sort of one degree separated from anyone in the soccer world, if you like. If I don't know them personally, I know someone who will. I think they liked that side of things. I think they did a lot of homework. Well, I know they did a lot of homework because there were a lot of people that called me to tell me that they've been checking up on me, which you would imagine people to do. I think they saw a work ethic in me that I instilled as a player that doesn't always correlate to how a person's going to be when they're retired. They had to do some checking up on that. And I also think they like my philosophy on how a team should play, what I want to try to get out of a squad, and the overall philosophy that I really want to make better what's in front of me at all times. I have no problem working under any budget structure, whether it be hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds or a salary cap structure. The staff that I've assembled will work really hard to make a very good, competitive working environment in front of us. And I think it was those were the values that they liked the most. But you can obviously ask Mike and Brian as well.
You mentioned your contacts around the world. You talk about the budget numbers. You're the head coach. How much of the team building, the roster building, the player acquisition side do you expect to be involved in? What will your relationship working-wise be with Mike Burns?
I'll be involved in all of it with Mike. That's for sure. And my staff will be involved along with us. We'll make our targets, and Mike will try to get the deals over the line. We'll leave no stone unturned. And if we can't hit one of our targets, we'll move on to the next. And we'll have a long list. Once we pinpoint a position that we need, we'll have quite a long list of players that will be able to come in and improve the team. I think one thing that's very important, that there's no sense in bringing a player in unless he's better than what we currently have. So we will be looking very hard, and as you can imagine, we've already pinpointed the positions that we want to improve on, and we're ready to get started now.
We know your credentials in terms of working with the youth soccer players, and we know the Revolution have had two great success stories in terms of homegrown players, with Diego Fagundes and Scotty Caldwell, but we haven't seen much else come out of their academy over the past few years. What is your relationship going to be like with the academy, and how are you going to work to help produce more players?
I mean, I'll have a very good relationship with Brian Scales in the academy. I think it's important that we try to produce players through the academy system. I think on the national team side of things, you have Justin Renix, who's currently at Indiana University. No, there was a bit of a story with him here at the club. You had Daniel Jones, who was in and out of the under-18s last cycle. He's gone to college, and then we have a very interesting prospect in Isaac Anking right now. The academy is something that I do know very well from all the scouting endeavors and all the showcases and playoffs, and it's something that we'll be very much hands-on with. We'll want to try to get as many players through the academy as possible. If an academy player is ready to come into the first team, they'll get the opportunity under me. If they're not ready, they won't. But at least the academy players are going to know that there is an avenue, there is a pathway, and there is a door open if they're going to commit themselves to working very hard and trying to make that step into the first team. So that's another exciting prospect to integrate the academy in a positive manner. And we need to get the soccer players, the ones very good technically but also physically, to try to get through the ranks.
You talked about commitment. You talked about work ethic from the team that you want to create. Soccer style, though, what type of philosophy do you want to work by? What should fans expect to see from the New England Revolution going forward?
Well, I'm not going to go into X's and O's and formations on the first day.
Right, you don't want to lay out your starting lineup for day one?
Exactly. There we go. but what people will see, and anyone who knows me personally, they know that they're going to get 100% committed group of players. And when I say committed, I don't mean it's going to be an ugly style of football. I love the creative style of football. If you look at the clubs that I've been at in my career, so even when I was at Brøndby in Denmark, it was at the time the biggest club in Denmark, a very attack-minded team. Liverpool, attack-minded. Blackburn, for most of the years that I was there, it was very attack-minded. Tottenham, attack-minded. Galatasaray, attack-minded. I love the attacking players with a lot of flair, but I also like the hard work. If you take two players that are two of the most technically gifted players in the world right now, Dele Alli and Christian Eriksen, they also cover a lot of the hard yards, the most hard yards throughout Europe. So the team's going to have to be committed in every aspect. I think that's one thing that our fans can guarantee, that we will have a team that's going to be very competitive. Hopefully very brave on the ball as well, but definitely very competitive.
Not tactically, but in terms of managing players, there's a lot of attacking pieces that are known quantities on this Revs team. Seems like it's been a bit of a puzzle how to get them all on the field or get them all comfortable. How do you manage those personalities? How do you manage those spots?
Well, first of all, I don't think getting players comfortable is something that we're going to target. I think what we're going to try to do is get the best 11 on the field to win each game. At times, some players are going to be upset because they're not in the team, and that's life. And I'll deal with that as and when. Players have to understand that they're part of a family. They have to understand that there are different roles within clubs, and they have to understand that they don't have a divine right to start. They have to earn their starts. Training is going to be very important when you play for our staff here and for the club. And there's going to be no automatic inclusions in the team. I think that's the most fair way to run things. And I think overall, once you get a squad that fully understands that, then you can have some success. Will there be some road bumps? Absolutely there will be, because there's going to be some players, maybe a few, that aren't going to want to accept that. And it happens at every club when new coaches come in. If they don't want to accept the new ideas, then you have to make your decisions. But that's why you're hired as a coach. And I think once you get your squad together and you get a real good feel and everyone's working hard and competing for those places, that's when you can achieve things.
One player specifically who's been in and out of the lineup, in and out of positions is Kellen Rowe. He had a great Gold Cup with the U.S. before heading home. And Jay Heaps actually used him at left back, at left wing, right wing, number 10. What kind of position do you think he works best in?
Well, when we get into preseason, when we start to train, I'll answer that question. We know as a staff, and don't worry, I'm not just trying to deflect. Well, yeah, I am trying to deflect on purpose. Let's not lie about things. So we know where we'd like to see him. I think it's important that he gets a run of months fully fit. I'm looking forward to seeing where the U.S. May or may not play him tomorrow, as well as Juan. So we'll have our sights set on that. I think it's very important that, like any player, that they come into preseason fully fit. And if they show us the qualities that they think they have, then I think they'll be very, very happy with some of their game time.
As a head coach, of course, you're going to cover all parts of the field, but your background being one of the great goalkeepers in U.S. history, you have a goalkeeper coach. Does that mean you're not going to, like, jump into sessions and give Cody Cropper some pointers?
I'll probably step in every now and again, but I have a goalkeeper coach, and he's very, very good, and he's far better looking than me as well. So I'll not walk over towards him too many times. So no, of course, I will give my 10 cents when I think it's needed. Ruben is an excellent goalkeeping coach. I wouldn't have brought him in if he wasn't. And hopefully the goalkeepers here will enjoy the training, and most importantly, that they have a healthy competitive relationship with all of them. Not easy for goalkeepers when they're not playing. I know that from personal experience. And generally speaking, it's one guy that gets the bulk of the games. But yeah, I'll help as much as I can. And I guess the good news on that position is I can definitely help out the number two and the number three when they're not playing, because I've definitely been in their shoes from time to time.
A lot of this year, the number one was Cody Cropper. He's one of the names when people talk about the future of the U.S. national team position. What do you see his skill set and his future?
Yeah, I've known Cody for a long time, and Cody was over at Southampton, and funny enough, he worked with the same staff that I ended my career with. So he had Tony Jimenez as the goalkeeping coach who works under Mauricio Pochettino. So we had a lot of talks about Cody, and I remember when New England Revolution were signing him, Mike Burns called me to ask what I thought about Cody Cropper before they signed the contract. Cody's going to be just like any other player coming in on preseason. He's going to come in and have to prove himself that he's going to be the number one goalkeeper, as are any of the other players. And does he have a bright future ahead of him? Yes, if he works hard and maintains fitness levels and maintains sharpness. But I see a real healthy goalkeeping competition on the cards here.
One of the big stories this year has been Atlanta United and Toronto FC and their big spending and the big stars that they've brought in. When you look at this Revolution squad, do they need that level of player, that level of addition to be successful next year? Is that the way MLS is going in your mind?
Two completely different ways of doing it with the way that they've spent the money. And Atlanta has been very impressive, especially Almiron and Martinez. They've been exceptional signings. And with Toronto, it was bringing in Jovinko and Josie and Michael on the funds that they did was a different way to go. Maybe with Michael, a little bit different age category, but they're both very, very good teams. I think Greg Vanney has done a wonderful job with Toronto, and Tata Martino for a team first time in the year has. I think what's really important, I'll revert back to what I said, is it's important that when we do make the additions are better than what we have. Because if you do that, then you have a really good roster, top to bottom. And these players are out there, you know, whether you have to spend a lot of money in transfer fees or the salary, it just depends on those players' club situations at the time. And if we have to spend money, perhaps we do so. If we can spend a little bit less, we'll try to do so as well. But to answer your question, I think, and maybe you can read between the lines, I think the signing of Almiron and Martinez have been outstanding, not just for Atlanta, but for the entire league.
Last question for you. You mentioned the U.S. national team playing against Portugal, trying to turn the page on the failed World Cup qualifying. One of the guys who's we think and hope is going to be a big part of the upcoming future is Christian McKenney. You were quoted talking about him, basically saying he's in the same conversation potentially as Christian Pulisic, and you said, I don't want to put a lot of pressure on him, but he's one of the outstanding talents. What should U.S. national team fans be excited about in looking at him, and what should they be looking for in terms of what his game will be like?
Yeah, Weston, the first time I had him in the camp, we saw a tremendous player. His fitness levels weren't where they needed to be. Technical ability was off the charts, and his work rate and endeavor to want to get better was incredible. We pressed him a lot, and we worked at that time directly with FC Dallas to get his mind focused exactly where it should be. Unfortunate for Dallas, and I guess fortunate for Schalke, he ended up going to Schalke. What's fortunate for the U.S. national team is that he's an American player. He is a box-to-box midfielder. He has an incredible engine. He can play as a six, or he can play as an eight. He can actually, if you get in a bind, you could put him as a 10. He's very athletic. He's very good in the air. He can tackle. He sees a pass. And as you can tell how I'm speaking about him, not a lot of weaknesses to his game other than he just needs games at the top senior level, which he's getting now with Schalke. And I'm really happy for him that he's in with the national team. And if he plays the amount of games that I think he will for Schalke, coming up in this next 12 to 18 months, you'll see a player that's right alongside Christian Pulisic in terms of ability. And that's an outstanding thing to have for the United States going forward, because we know what a wonderful player Christian is himself.
Going forward for the New England Revolution, a lot to be excited about. Brad Friedel, the new head coach, heading in towards his first offseason and then season in Major League Soccer. Coach, thanks so much for taking the time with us.
My pleasure, guys. Enjoy.
Wow, exciting words from Brad Friedel on a couple different planes. One, what he had to say about Weston McKennie and potentially his future, but more importantly, for New England Revolution fans, what that club's going to look like going forward. And Doyle, what was really interesting to me was when I asked him about high-profile signings and big-time players, and he talked about the difference between Atlanta and Toronto, and he mentioned, you can read between the lines, I think Miguel Almiron and Joseph Martinez were really special signings and impressive signings. What do you see about the New England Revolution under Brad Friedel?
Well, nothing yet. But if you do read between those lines, what he seems to be saying is that they're going to target younger players, players maybe just entering their prime or even a couple years away from their prime, rather than going after guys who are at the tail end of their prime or even, you know, past their prime, which is, I mean, to me, that makes sense, not only because, I mean, you look at the on-field effect of Almiron and Martinez, but what Friedel seemed to be hinting at is, well, he said it, like, they're going to change the way MLS teams operate. What he's saying is that both these guys are going to end up being sold for eight figures. They're going to make a huge profit off these guys. It's a new way to bring money into teams and into the league. And if you're not going to get on that ship, you are going to be left behind by the way MLS does business in the coming decade. And I think that's smart for the Revs. Now, whether they have enough of a transfer budget to go out and get a guy like Almiron, or to pay the salary of Joseph Martinez.
Because, Doyle, for fans understanding this, right, from the outside, these players aren't cheaper. They just have the potential to bring back money at the end.
Right, right. I mean, we've seen reports recently, I think Christian Dyer and our own Sam Stashkill had it at somewhere around $20-25 million offered for Miguel Almiron, which would more than double the investment that Atlanta United made on him. I've seen even more. I've heard through the Whisper Network that it's $30 million or more. So if you can triple your investment on a player, then no matter what you spent up front, that was a cheap player for you to have. So, you know, and I think that's what Brad Friedel was getting at. And if you look at his connections with clubs in England specifically, but I'm sure he has connections across Europe, given he was there for 20 years, playing for Brad Friedel has a certain level of cachet, or playing, having that Brad Friedel stamp of approval, I'm sure has a certain level of cachet. And I think that's what the Revs are going to try to take advantage of. It's MLS evolving, I think, into a selling league. And it's, you know, it's years overdue. And I look forward to seeing what this team can do with it, because you know they're going to do it on a different kind of budget than what Atlanta managed.
Ben, we didn't have you on last week when we talked about this acquisition, him being made head coach by the Revs, talking to him there for about 20-25 minutes. What's your takeaway of the type of coach he's going to be, the type of team the Revs are going to be going forward?
I don't think we have any idea what like type of team they're going to be on the field. I think my main takeaway from what he was saying is that he used an old Jurgen Klinsmann line in there, saying he wants to make basically players uncomfortable and not have players assured spots on the team. I think there's going to be a lot of turnover from what we've seen from these other Revs teams. I think who he places where is going to be the most interesting, and how he builds an identity in New England, which is something that I think they've tried to build in the past, but it's something that hasn't really been accomplished for various reasons. And I just want to see what kind of belief he's going to instill in the team.
A lot of people talked to him, and he talked about it in his press conference and then spoke to us about the budget and what he has to spend. But there's quality on that roster. They're not that far off from being a competitive MLS team. There's just some holes that have not been filled, and there hasn't been a cohesive unit that's been put together going forward. We'll see what happens. Of course, next week the MLS playoffs continue. We're going to do a lot of preview for you on Thursday and then on Monday again. And, of course, you can watch MLS Playoff Central before and after every single one of these games. Mapfre Stadium for the first leg in the Eastern Conference, BBVA for the first leg in the Western Conference. We're hearing that both are sold out already for next Tuesday night's game. And for Toronto FC, they are still waiting on word about Jozy Altidore and whether or not he'll be suspended for that first leg. Doyle, how much does this affect the way they're training going forwards?
I mean, it's tough to say. Just the uncertainty of it is going to, I would imagine, be problematic between now and, you know, next Tuesday. But at the same time, we've talked about it a million times on this show. Toronto have so much depth, and they've been able to win games with so many different lineups, playing so many different styles. I think once they have clarity, they'll be able to lock in and just, you know, almost like riding a bike. Like they know how to play a 5-4-1 with Toussaint Ricketts as the lone forward. They did it a half dozen times this year. So I don't think it's going to be catastrophic for them, but obviously it's not ideal.
We will see what happens. We are looking forward to those playoffs as well. Next game, though, on our calendar is the U.S. national team playing against Portugal. We're going to preview it all in the second segment.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions. Ooh, I'm a rebel just for kicks. I've been feeling it since 1966.
Back now on Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental and MLSsoccer.com and SiriusXM FC Channel 85. We move back into the international field. We spoke to Dave Sarakin a little bit last week. Looking forward to this game. Doyle, when you look at this roster, 21 guys called in, a lot of young players. Alejandro Bedoya at 30 years old is the oldest player on this team. What are you most interested by going into the matchup against Portugal?
The young guys. There's no other way to put it. I thought Matt Miazga, I mean, he's been great for Vitesse since he moved there on loan from Chelsea. And I thought he was great at the Gold Cup and wish he had been on the team more during qualifying. Cameron Carter-Vickers, who I've not been high on, has been good for Sheffield United. You know, those two guys in the back. Obviously, Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie. Lyndon Gooch, I'm not quite so high on, but those guys in central midfield, or Gooch maybe on the wing. And then up top, I don't think Josh Sargent is going to play. I think he's there just to get a taste, and that's cool. I still have a lot of Juan Agudelo stock.
I was waiting for that one.
You have a lot of Juan Agudelo stock?
Yeah, I cannot. I he's still just 24. And
that alone is amazing by itself, by the way.
How long has he been? How long has he been a professional?
This year, and it didn't. But I think that was because he was played out of position. So I'm hoping he gets a chance to play as a true center forward in this one. Maybe with like kind of a 4-3-3 with Adams and McKennie both in central midfield, and we get to see something fun and exciting and young and kind of like turn the page, because what we had the last 4 years was miserable. And that's not to say that I never want to see those guys again, but like it feels appropriate to start with a group that had almost no connection to the group that lost in Trinidad and Tobago last month.
Do you worry at all that in Adams, McKennie, central midfield, let's say Kellen Acosta gets thrown in there as well, Agudelo up top, that team maybe, if it goes 3-0 against them, 4-0 against them, that ends up in any way hurting these players?
No, it's a friendly. It's a random friendly during essentially a non-World Cup cycle for these guys. I think it can only help. And especially because, look, ideally we get a Miazga, John Brooks starting central defense. And then if you have that and you have DeAndre Yedlin out there and I guess Viafania left back, like you're not going to give up more than two goals to a Portugal team that's playing without Ronaldo. I might have just jinxed it right there. I'd like the fact that we have so much talent in the back. It allows you to play a little bit fun in midfield and up top.
Ben, what most interests you?
Just seeing these players play, like just different players in the U.S. jersey. I mean, this is one of the more meaningless games that the U.S. has ever played. I mean, we're literally, how long are we until the next World Cup? 4.5 years away? It's just seeing new players play in the U.S. jersey.
Okay. Well, what would make you happy? If we did this again, and we will for Club and Country after the whistle on MLSsoccer.com after the game tomorrow, what's going to put a smile on your face, or what will at least say this was worthwhile for me?
Like Tyler Adams hits a great cross or just blows somebody up in the midfield, or Weston McKennie strings some passes together.
Okay.
Basically, nothing really relating to the scoreline is really going to have any effect on my personal well-being and my feelings towards the U.S. national team right now.
Doyle?
Body language, aggression. We all saw the first half against Trinidad and Tobago, and I'll never forget that for the rest of my life, just how disinterested and not up for it that team looked. And I think that was part and parcel of what had been beaten into them basically since 2011. I want to see that this group has the mental strength to not be like that. No matter what happens, no matter how – Ben's right, this is a meaningless game. But no matter how meaningless, I don't ever want to see a U.S. team play like that again. So I want to see them come out on the front foot and come out with intent and come out playing hard. And the good thing about Adams and McKennie and Miazga in particular, those three guys, nobody always plays well. But if you watch those three guys, I have never seen a single one of them take a playoff. They are always just so locked in. And I love that about that group. I love that about the last two U20 national team groups, and those three guys were parts of that to an extent. And that's what I want to see from this team. I want to see the attitude that the U20s have had in 2015 and 2017 brought to the full national team. And I think it starts with, obviously, those three guys and Christian Pulisic as well.
So we got an email here from CM Leota that I'm not saving for the mailbag. I'm going to use it here. It's a little bit long, but he gets out some emotion, and I appreciate that. He says, I just stomached the Dave Sarokin interview somehow. I appreciate that as well for listening. If this guy's serious, how is it even remotely possible that nearly everyone involved in the most embarrassing moment in U.S. sports history can fail to recognize the significance and accept blame? Gulati, Altidore, Bradley, Arena, and now the current coach simply refused to acknowledge the weight and impact of this failure that still haunts my dreams a month later and will only get worse. Sarokin said he wouldn't change anything in the preparation. Are you freaking kidding me? That was the worst prepared team in the history of sports. Obviously an exaggeration. We were undone by a freak own goal. We sleepwalked through the opening minutes, deserved to be losing. Second half was strong for a couple minutes. After the first 2 minutes of the second half, we went back to sleep and didn't make any subs until it was too late. Then Sarokin had the audacity to say that the players' legacies aren't defined by one game. Have you ever watched sports in your 90 years? Players' legacies are made on one game all the time. These 99% of these players, coach, and staff will all be remembered for this. This is disgraceful. I expected this from U.S. Soccer would just hire another dinosaur that belittles fans. To pour salt in the wound, Sarokin said that his opportunity to take these young kids to Portugal balances out the failure to qualify for the World Cup. I'm disgusted and disappointed, and I fear that this will only get worse over the next 6 months. Doyle, he then says, I disagree with Doyle that the interim coach doesn't really matter. He is perpetuating all the issues that U.S. soccer has. Now, we've talked a lot over the last few weeks about what happened, what needs to happen, what needs to be looked at. Dave Sarokin said in the press conference before this game that he wouldn't blow it all up and burn it all down and change everything. Doyle, from what you're hearing from that point of view and this fan saying what he feels like he's hearing from Dave Sarokin, do you think the internal audit is really occurring in U.S. soccer?
I don't think it's happened yet. in the sense that our angry young friend is talking about. But I think that a big chunk of the internal audit started 10 years ago with the founding of the USSDA, and, you know, going away from ODP programs and then, you know, building up the youth national team programs, the fruits of which we've seen in terms of results at the U17 and then the U20 level, and the U20 level is infinitely more important. A lot of the processes and structures are in place. They need to be expanded. They don't need to be torn down. They need to be expanded. They need to be made more accessible to marginalized communities, whether those are urban or rural or ethnic, that USSF has not done as good a job of reaching out to as I think they could have. And that is, certain MLS teams have done a very good job. FC Dallas, the Red Bulls, RSL, and others have not so much. You learn what went wrong, for sure. And I think that I agree to a good extent that a lot of the people involved in the catastrophe in Trinidad and Tobago have been disappointingly blasé about it. And I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to cry if those people are not no longer have such a hand on the tiller of U.S. soccer. But you can also learn from what's going right. And if you look at our youth system, if you look at certain aspects of our youth soccer structure, there's a lot of stuff going right. Finding the people who are doing, I mean, Luchi Gonzalez in FC Dallas, you know, finding the people who are doing things right and empowering them and giving them more resources and then using that blueprint town by town, eventually nationwide, that to me is the more constructive way to talk about U.S. soccer moving forward than about burning it down and ostracizing people and you know, deciding, okay, it's time, we've missed one World Cup, so it's time to start everything over again from scratch. That never makes sense to me. That's not, I don't think that's how progress happens. And, you know, but I understand that some, you know, with a spectacular failure like this, there's always the desire to see some heads roll.
Ben, do you see any frustration in that Dave Sarakin's the one leading this team now after being a part of one?
No, I didn't really understand that. I didn't get a chance to listen to the interview, but Dave Sarakin is not.
Ben's a huge ETR fan, by the way.
I just didn't. Yeah, I was listening to it before we started recording it so I can see what you guys are saying. Dave Sarakin is not going to be the coach of this team in 6 months. So I don't really see the point of getting upset about what Dave Sarakin is saying currently.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's an adequate head coach as long as he keeps playing the kids. For whether, like, he might run the January camp as well. I doubt he'll be kept on beyond that. As long as he calls in the kids and plays the kids, then for the next 4 months, he's fine. And then I still hope that Tab Ramos is brought in as the interim coach. I know he wants to be the head coach, but I don't think he should be. But I hope he's brought in as the interim head coach up until after the World Cup, at which point whoever the USSF president is, whoever the decision makers are, can sit down and do a thorough search of, you know, globally for the next U.S. national team head coach,
Doyle,
which I think will be Tata Martino. So there you go.
You would wait until after the next World Cup because candidates then become available, because you want that clean cycle, or because you think it takes that long to assess what you need?
The first two. I think there will be a larger and better pool of candidates available. And I think that you want the clean 4-year cycle. We have had, I can't remember the last time we've had a national team coach take over at the start of a cycle and have a contract that runs through the end of the cycle.
I guess it would be Bruce into 06.
Yeah, but like that was his second.
Oh, right.
Like,
good call.
That
was
an 8-year cycle for
right.
Bruce.
Yes.
So I hope that what we end up having is just a good 4-year chunk, which feels like the right amount of time for a national team coach, unless you happen to luck into having a Yogi Löw. So
The other part of the conversation this week around U.S. soccer circles is the Players Tribune article that Christian Pulisic penned, in which he talked about his devastation from not qualifying, what the next few years look like, but also delved into his own development and what he takes from that and hopes that maybe can help players in the future. And he talked about, like Doyle said, the talented players that exist around the country. And one of the things he keyed on was his moving to Dortmund at the age of 16 and getting pushed at that age, and feels like 16 to 18 is that sweet spot. And his Croatian passport gave him that opportunity. First of all, pretty impressive from a young 19-year-old player to put together these thoughts in this coherent way and express this, especially at such a down time. When you look at, you talked about, Doyle, 10 years ago, USDA coming in, things already changing. Is it going towards the direction of what Pulisic's talking about?
I mean, obviously, he speaks from a level of expertise and just personal experience that I can't, and that, you know, 99.999% of soccer players can't. It is worth remembering that guys like Junior Flores and Joe Joao went there as well and did not develop as I think everybody had hoped. So there's no guarantees, and that's part of his point. The closest thing you can do to buying good luck in player development is to improve and expand upon a workable structure, a workable system. Because like Pulisic says, you know, there are other kids in his age group who were probably more talented than him and never got identified. And we can't rely upon Borussia Dortmund to just happen to identify a world-class level talent that we produce. We can't. We can't even rely upon the USU-17s to do that. We need to be able to do it systemically, whether it's MLS academies or NASL or USL or on down the line. That needs to be in every reasonably sized town, and it needs to be comprehensive, and then it needs to be cultural from the top down. I'm talking from ownership to GM to the coach on down, that you get these guys, if you're good enough, you're old enough, you get them minutes. And some teams in MLS do that really well. RSL was spectacular with that this year. The Red Bulls obviously were great. Dallas were not as good this year as they have been in the past, but I think that's going to reverse again. So there are places where this is happening. It just needs to happen faster and more and be more widespread, because the only way for MLS to get to the level that I think we all want it to get to is to have a cultural commitment to building up our own youth players. If we don't do that, then, I mean, then we're not going to end up being that league of choice.
I read the piece by Pulisic. I thought it was great. I thought it was very well informed. One of my main takeaways is that he's also a special case. You can't build your entire strategy around finding guys like Christian Pulisic. He would be the first to tell you he's a special case. His dad would be the first to tell you he's a special case. And just basing what we should be doing off of his success is not something that I think we should be doing in the U.S. soccer community at all.
A lot to look at for U.S. national team squad, for the fans, for U.S. soccer right now. 3:45 p.m. Eastern time on Fox Sports 1 and Univision is that one. And then we'll be back with Club and Country after the whistle to hopefully talk about some of the promising performances for some of these young players. MLS players, a lot of international matches going on this week, but a couple that really matter for World Cup spots. Honduras 0-0 going into the second leg in Australia. That will happen Wednesday at 4 a.m. Eastern time on ESPN3. I'll be up for that one.
There's some tension with that one because Honduras just accused Australia of spying on their trainings with a drone.
God, I love international soccer so much. And then 9:15 p.m. Eastern time on Wednesday, Peru and New Zealand coming back the other way. They'll play in Peru. That one at 0-0 as well. Four MLS players for New Zealand in the first leg, and Yoshi Yotun going about 86 minutes for Peru as well. And then Switzerland qualifying for the World Cup 1-0 over the course of two legs. Aggregate against Northern Ireland. Thank God Northern Ireland didn't get into the World Cup. I don't need three more matches of that. Bleram Jamaili started both games for Switzerland, which, if you look at their squad, especially the attacking pieces, one of the better teams in the world. So impressive performances from him and that team. We'll be back after the break with your mailbag.
Fans, we want to hear from you. you're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Back now on Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental and MLSsoccer.com and SiriusXMFC Channel 85. We are also running a advice page for Andrew Wiebe and his parenting skills. So if you'd like to send any emails, you can also tweet us 401-206-0MLS or Extra Time at MLSsoccer.com. I will forward all of those to Andrew, but I promise you, I got an email at 1:30 this morning about Extra Time Radio. So he is like obsessively locked in when he should be focused on reading.
He's listening to everything that we're saying and grading it on a 1 to 10 scale.
And then we're going to get commentary back afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, come on, Andrew, where's your focus right now? We're going to have to ask that question. We'll ask him when he gets back, whenever that may be. We talked a little bit about youth development in the last segment, and we talked about MLS's role, and we talked about U.S. soccer and what needs to happen going forward. Dan Quartermunch tweeting out that this year was a record year for MLS homegrowns. During the 2017 season, they played a record number of minutes at 74,425 minutes, and both goals and assists this year were up 200% compared to the 2014 season. This year was 78 goals and 94 assists, and the year he mentioned, of course, 39 goals, 35 assists in 2014. Impressive. Is this the turning point? Have we already reached the turning
point?
What
turning point?
I don't know. Is there going to be a homegrown MLS player that is the difference maker for an MLS Cup winner in the next 3 to 5 years?
I mean, wasn't Jordan Morris pretty integral to Seattle last year?
Yeah. But Lodeiro was MVP, right?
Jossie Zardes scored a goal in LA's win in 2014.
I love that Matt Toro's going to die on that Jossie Zardes hill.
Tyler
right
Adams personally pissed off two of the best U.S. national team players.
So you think that if Crew SC wins MLS Cup this year because Josie got suspended because Tyler Adams pissed him off?
Yeah, so that counts.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if they win MLS Cup this year, Will Trapp is their captain.
Yeah.
But to go to your point, and I think the larger point that Quartermunch, who is the executive VP of MLS Communications. There is no turning point. There is a growth curve. And if you look, the growth hasn't been exactly linear. MLS players actually played more minutes and more games in 2015 than 2016. But there was a big jump this year. Like in 2015, Academy players started 600 games. In 2017, it was 800. They played 815 minutes in 2015. They played 1,200 minutes. They played 55,000 minutes in 2015. They played 75,000 minutes in 2017. As long as that growth curve continues, then I remain fairly confident that a lot of the right things are being done. But there are, you know, there are individual markets that are struggling. There are, look, it's a lot easier for a homegrown to get on the field in defense than it is at center forward or playmaker. So these are all things that I think have to be looked at. And part of it is like, look, MLS Academy player production used to mean very young players. In 2017, we've had academies for 10 years. So part of academy player production, it's like, oh yeah, we have a 24-year-old who's been with this team for 5 years now. I guess we're confident in getting him some more minutes. That confidence has to start coming when those guys are 18, 19, 20 years old. So I still think there's a cultural issue there. There are signs it's getting better, but it is in need of some serious improvement.
Well, talking about players getting younger and younger players getting more playing time, Jeff Reuter tweeting out that he's hearing that NYCFC has entered preliminary discussions with Manchester City about Yaya Toure. That was sarcasm, by the way. Yaya Toure is not a young player. NYC wants him to join the team in January. Man City would prefer the summer transfer window. Is this going to happen? after everyone's talked about it for like 2.5 years, and is this does this make NYCFC better for next year?
I think we have. I want to go with we don't know for the second part of that question. I don't see Yongo Herrera back with this team next year. So having being able to slot on Yaya Toure in that spot seems like a pretty good option. Or moving Alex Ring to the number 8 position and playing Yaya as the D mid.
No way.
Yaya won't even play D mid for Manchester City.
This dude's coming in to play number 10 in the Pirlo role, which would be very exact, I think, with how he would perform, which is a lot of minutes off the bench.
The good news for Yaya is that he actually doesn't need to run as much because the field is because the field at Yankee Stadium is smaller than the other fields in this league.
Doyle, he was a world-class player. Can he add to NYCFC at this time in his career?
I mean, he's, what, 33?
34.
Or actually, he's 34. He'll be almost 35 basically at the start of next season. He hasn't played much at all this season. He played, I think, around 2,000 minutes last year. So he probably has something left in the tank. But it's I mean, maybe, look, when you sign guys this age, you either get David Villa or you get Andrea Pirlo. And they're rolling the dice that Yaya Toure will be closer to the David Villa end of the spectrum. It's not what I would do. It's not how I would build an MLS team. It's not how Brad Friedel would apparently build an MLS team. And I would certainly prefer to have Yanhel Herrera in the league for another year. But like Ben, I think that's unlikely. You don't know how it works out until you see it. Because we all remember Yaya Toure in his prime. He could just run an entire midfield by himself. If NYCFC get that guy for 2,000 minutes next year, they'll probably be pretty happy with him.
Yeah, and he's a guy who can see the pass. So he is a guy who can play in a couple of different ways for that team, but definitely would not be one who's going to cover ground and cover your back line. Let's move on to a debate we had last week. We talked about dynasties and MLS. Bearder Jack sent us, obviously, a great email. Seattle Brad here. That's just his. That's just what he's going to go by. That's his brand, Ben. So just so you can understand that, this guy's branding himself already. That's how it works.
That's how it works?
That's how it works. As a Sounders fan, 2011 to 2016 Seattle is not a dynasty. As much as I'd love to call them one, it feels like LA Galaxy always had our number. If the Sounders win the 2014 MLS Cup, then they have the treble and are a dynasty. Losing to the Galaxy in 2014 Western Finals is reminiscent of the 90s Utah Jazz with Malone and Stockton. They were good but would always lose to Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen's Bulls. A dynasty requires three things. One, overwhelming consent that they're the best team in the league during the season, aka domination of your opponents. Two, at least one trophy every other year, no downtime for a dynasty. And three, extended success for 4 years. 3 years may seem long in MLS, but it's not enough for legendary status of dynasty. In his book, 90s DC United and 2010 to 2014 LA Galaxy are the only two MLS dynasties. 2016 MLS Cup doesn't count for the Sounders dynasty in 2011. 26th season was a mess that ended with Lodeiro coming and them getting to MLS Cup. Ben? Has he convinced you?
That's a lot
way?
To take in. No, he has not convinced me.
Did you think the 2011-2016 Sounders are a dynasty?
No. Two different. Different teams.
That the Sporting KC teams in this time are
no,
a dynasty?
No, one MLS Cup is not enough.
So how many MLS dynasties do you have?
I would throw in the San Jose Houston thing from the mid 2000s is an interesting case, but I think you have to throw them in there.
Even though they switch cities?
Even though they switch cities. Okay. It's tough. I know it's difficult to think about it that way.
I think you were on the pro-Seattle dynasty side against Weeby on this one?
No, I was just playing devil's advocate there. Look, if they win MLS Cup this year, then you look at 2014 through 2017 and say, yeah, that team's a dynasty because they won the Shield Open Cup double in 2014, didn't win anything in 2015, and then will have been back-to-back MLS Cup winners in 16 and 17. That's a dynasty.
But is there
over 4 years
player holdover from 2014 to 2017 to call it like a core dynasty?
I mean,
Ozzy.
That's my thing with Dynasty. Like, you remember Dynasty because of the players that played in those games.
Like, we said, Keane, Donovan.
Yeah, all these players have been different. Dempsey wasn't even didn't even play in the last half of last season. Lodeiro wasn't on the 2014 team.
Yeah, it makes it arguable. It definitely makes it arguable in a way. Either way, if you look back at this, what it really says is that Seattle Sounders fans are the most spoiled fans in the league. They have won 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They've won 6 titles since coming into the 6 major trophies since coming into the league 9 years ago, and maybe 7 is coming. They've won literally like Open Cup 4 times, Shield once, MLS Cup. Like, this team has been so good that, I mean,
did Seattle invent dynasties? Did Seattle invent
dynasties? Right, right as you delivered the kill shot, you cut out, so I couldn't quite hear you, but I think I know what you said.
Oh, God. Well, Seattle Sounders, they're 1 week away from the first leg of the Western Conference Finals here in 2017. They're going to go to Houston to start that one off. And, of course, Toronto FC will be at Mapfre Stadium. We will have all your previews coming up over the next 2 episodes, all your reactions, of course. As always, we are really looking forward to it. Now we're in it. 1 week away, we are into the Western Conference, Eastern Conference Finals, and then to MLS Cup, where we will be cold no matter what, and it will be fun no matter what. Thank you so much to Ben Bear and Matt Doyle. Thank you, of course, to Brad Friedel for joining us on this one. Congratulations once again to the Weeby clan, and for myself, David Goss, thanks so much for listening.